disdain idolatry, caution against romance, find symbolism suspect, celebrate the contingent and mortal over the cosmic. They tend to favor with Denise Levertov an encounter over a pledge or a contract, a meeting over the vice of wedlock. They exult with Mona Van Dyne in the tension of this duel of amateurs, in the freedom of a relation which recognizes differences between the duelists. One thought, he is not me, and one, she is not me. They seem to prefer the bulky knowledge, the visceral particularity of marriage over its metaphorical possibilities. And here's a snip from Van Dyne's poem on marriage. What symbol comes anywhere near suggesting it? No, the notion of art won't fit it unless when it's embodied. For digression there is meaningful and takes such joy in the slopes and crannies that every bony gesture is generous, full, all lacy with veins and nerves. These new songs from the bride tend to revel in less monumental meetings, less neurotically charged passions, less drama. There is more humor, more irony, more pleasure, more commitment to process and movement in these new epithalamia than in the entire history of women's poetry on marriage. Do you have time to listen to one more poem? Can I go through Patricia's? Patricia Stories has written what I take to be perhaps the most compelling of contemporary epithalamia in Pamina's marriage speech. That's the last one that you have there. A poem which I would like to read with you by way of conclusion. The poem is both a formal epithalamium in its own right and a rewriting of Pamina's role in Mozart's The Magic Flute by assigning to her not aria, but speech. Pamina does not have much of a voice in Mozart's opera to begin with. She also reaches her highest registers inspired by the thought of a suicidal tryst with her bridegroom Death at the heart of Act Two, until she is persuaded to desist by the boys who bring her to her real bridegroom and reverse her fortunes. Throughout Mozart's opera, as in the traditional epithalamia, the bride is in the grip of forces which act upon her. Pamina's marriage speech, by contrast, avoids the high notes of aria, presenting an honest but agnostic epithalamium, as she calls it, in the level tones of committed human speech. This poem earns the right to reinscribe the brilliant torches of the traditional hymeneal hymn at the close by thoroughly revising nuptial convention. Pamina, in her own voice, replaces the genre's certainties with conditionals by contracting her own marriage otherwise with her new husband-to-be. The poem moves from romantic death marriage to a real-life lasting one, from the steely certainty of blade to the malleable gold of wedding band, from cynicism and despair to a praise of love, conventional but newly coded in a language and tones of possibility. Love is at best dubiety, sustained connection, that questionable reality, unlikely but possible like resurrection. The venture requires vigilance and change on both sides. I'm going to read just a little piece of this poem. Guard, O my husband of the literal sex, against the male bias toward the radiant spasm of heroic loss. Sad captains gathered at the last feast to applaud the old lion's shaggy final roar and toss love on the fire. Ecstatic holocaust, suspiciously similar to male orgasm. You see the carnal parallel I make, so I too, for my husband's sake, will discipline my woman's love of endless possibility. The Maenad's blind absorption in sensation, the response, naive, momentous, to any cynic's predatory kiss by which our love of fresh beginning, generation, follows bad directions and misprinted signs to that much using three-way promiscuity. Remember, too, that love contains, but is not an emotion, is not romance, that color photograph of a smiling couple on a short vacation whose kisses are purchased, pretty souvenirs, in gabled shops with good views of the ocean. Love is, in supreme form, concentration. Enough of this. Raise the veil, beloved. Now I've made it dark enough to kiss. And teach those guests we've rendered skeptical, love passionate as doubt, as radical. By these hands in perfect light, receive a resonance of knowledge. Through flickering palms, lucid embrace, read by this uncertain flame, read by this uncertain flame, achieve description of a face. Pray that we withstand the shock of blessing, assembled friends with lowered heads. Pray urgently that we may make for good the crucial and ecstatic risk we take, following brilliant torches to this bed. This poem does not only invoke and reinvest with new meaning the shop-worn conventions of the traditional epithalamium, ideas of generation, bridal innocence and perfection, monogamy and lifelong commitment, hymeneal torches signifying publicity and social compact. Pamina's marriage speech speech also names love as a kind of knowledge rather than simply a feeling, as the lucid seeing face to face which freed Psyche to love Eros and him to love her, as a full illumination of what happens in that uncertain space between persons, as a humorous recognition of and commitment to change our inheritance of gendered responses in love, finally, as the crucial and ecstatic, specific and personal risk we take now in following Hymen's torches to the marriage bed. One more paragraph. The history of the epithalamium, as this recuperation of women's variance has been designed to demonstrate, is incomplete without the record of challenges to its generic borders that women poets have left to us as legacy. My research indicates that the overt prohibition against writing highly codified ceremonial poetry has been less causal in the exile of women poets from the canon than an excessively rigorous definition of poetic genre. As the spectrum of responses indicates, a theory of genre might profitably invite more telling of individual stories and less taxonomy of a generic form. If women poets are to take their rightful places as makers of the canon, we must use inclusivity rather than a gender-biased exclusivity as a criterion of value. We need to ask why female revision of genre has been viewed as a defacing of it, a judgment which disqualifies women's epithalamia as contributions to the tradition. We also need to understand how the criterion of generic purity has gone hand in hand with an idealization of woman as object of love in the poetry of marriage, as if erotic and aesthetic purity were equivalent and equally crucial to preserve. Equally important for genre theory is the refusal of the female epithalamium to make a pure generic statement. Although women's epithalamia share important themes, elements of critical stance and self-location, they do not set up, I am relieved to say, an alternate reified canon of ovarian in place of phallic strategies. The questions I have raised today remain provocative and open to further discussion. Does the experience of being the same sex as one's mother and the project of becoming a mother oneself make a difference in women's songs of love? Has the persistence of the Demeter-Persephone myth as an explanation of women's psychology tied women poets irrevocably to a nuptial poetics of loss, rape, and rupture? Does women's experience of the erotic differ so substantially from man's that her love poetry will always be different, will always articulate an experience essentially her own? What would be the conditions, the costs of change? We would do well to consider these questions at greater length because, as Marianne Moore warns in her poem called Marriage, everything to do with love is a mystery. It is more than a day's work to investigate this science. So in fact, these papers do, I think, to a certain extent, speak to each other. When you said, when you sort of pointed us forward and said, but that is another story, when women sort of claim control over their own marriage plots, I think some of the history would almost indicate how that happens.
Well, a real difference between the late poets that you're writing about and Jane Austen is that women writers in the 19th century almost never married, particularly the novelists. Elizabeth Barrett Browning was married, but very, very few women writers in the 19th century married. So marriage was a plot, but not one that involved them.
That's right.
Ken West was the last poem that was one of these women.
The last poem, the Pamina's Marriage song, this is a great chance for me to make a plug. It's by Patricia Storace, the new poet who's going to read at Barnard Women Poets Series next Thursday night. Yeah. Are there any questions from the floor? Patricia Storace, S-T-O-R-A-C-E. And she's reading here next Thursday night with Sharon Owens. Questions?
Can I ask about a different Jane Austen novel? I kind of like to hear a feminist interpretation of Emma's marriage to Mr. Knightley.
Oh, here it comes. Did you
better this?
This is a setup, right? That was the part that I had to leave out of the papers.
Oh, really?
I should make somebody else tell the story about it. Well, I think I'll begin by telling you an anecdote of a dinner party that I went to in January, right before I was getting ready for second semester and teaching Emma. And at this dinner party, I met a fairly well-known novelist and translator who said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm teaching the 19th century English novel." And she said, "Well, of course you're teaching Emma. Austen, are you teaching Emma?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Isn't Mr. Knightley the most perfect hero that you can imagine?" And I thought, well, I better go for it. And I said, "No. I don't really think so." So here's what, I mean, here's...
Margaret Drabble actually answers that in one of her novels. She said, poor Emma, she got shafted. Frank Churchill was so sexy. I think she says that in one of her
Yeah, okay, well, here's, Celeste asked me to make notes about Emma, so let me look at my notes. I think I want to answer your question by talking about what happens to the Pamela plot in Emma. Because I think that the question of feminism in Austen, or, you know, to yoke feminism and Austen together is very problematic. Because in ways, Austen's very conservative, although she's so smart, we all know she's also very radical. I mean, I do think she's the smartest of all women novelists by far, certainly in the 19th century. If in Mansfield Park the Pamela plot is subverted in all the ways that I named, in Emma it's not really subverted so much as displaced. And where it's displaced is into subplots. I mean, how does Emma begin? It begins Emma Woodhouse, and now you'll hear something from my paper. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich. She's just like Henry Crawford. She's handsome, clever, and rich. Lived for most of her 21 years with little to distress or vex her. That's how that novel begins. She's never been vexed, she's never been bothered, and she's never been in love. Because love is very vexing. Well, I mean, a heroine who is handsome, clever, and rich is apparently as unlike Pamela as any heroine be. And it seems like, on that score, the Pamela plot has nothing to do with Emma. But the Pamela plot has a lot to do with Emma. In Emma, the Pamela plot is displaced into two subplots. There's first of all the story of Jane Fairfax and Frank Churchill. And Jane Fairfax is very much like Pamela. She's poor, she's to make her own way in the world. She's to be a governess until last minute Frank's aunt, Mrs. Churchill, dies. Leaves him a lot of money, and he gets to marry Jane and liberate her from what she describes as being not unlike slavery. The other Pamela plot in Emma is one that Emma invents. That's the plot that Emma gets to marry off Harriet to Mr. Elton. Now, Mr. Elton really isn't like Mr. B. I mean, he's not quite as nasty as Mr. B, or he's nasty in different ways, let's just say. But that's a plot that Emma makes up, and Austen trashes Emma for that, and Emma learns to trash herself from that. She calls herself an imaginist. But that's also a plot that tries to marry a relatively powerless young woman to a man with much more status and therefore power. There are two Pamela plots. One of them is totally discredited because it never really gets finished. The marriage of Harriet Smith and Mr. Elton never happens. In fact, Harriet marries a member of the yeomanry, Robert Martin, who's very wise but also patriarchally smart and keeps her in line. Okay. I want to say that I think that Austen, what you're talking about feminist readings of Mr. Knightley and Emma, all of that has to do with the way the Pamela plot erupts all over Emma in completely uncontrollable ways. Now, first of all, I think the Pamela plot is fueled, as I said, by the specter of rape. Pamela's real vulnerability is that Mr. B could rape her and get away with it. I mean, he could call it seduction, but it could be rape, and he could get away with it. I totally shocked my class. We had a discussion that went on forever. It went on for 3 weeks, I think, because I came to class one day this semester and I said, the problem in Emma is rape. For those of you who've read Emma, you will remember that at the end of the first third of the novel, at the end of volume one, Emma goes to a party with everybody in her family, and at the end it's snowing and they all pile into carriages. And Emma's father and her sister and brother-in-law and all of their children pile into one carriage, leaving no room for Emma, therefore violating the rules of propriety. She's got to go with Mr. Elton in his carriage. She's been trying to get Mr. Elton to marry Harriet Smith, but of course Mr. Elton is interested in her, and you can't even use the word love. And Austen says that Mr. Elton makes violent love to Emma. Now what she means by makes violent love to is not unlike what you heard me read Henry Crawford do to Fanny, that is, talk to. But it seems to me that makes violent love is a euphemism that's really maybe not a euphemism, because what could happen to a young woman alone with a young man in a carriage? They're alone. It is entirely improper, and also not at all Emma's fault that she's alone in this carriage with this young man. So it seems to me that, you know, on the one hand, the specter of the Pamela plot erupts in this scene of a rape of Emma that never happens. And it's interesting that that's the moment in the novel at which Emma really begins to be a sympathetic character. And, you know, in case you didn't get the point in volume one, you can get the point in volume three. Because Harriet Smith goes for a walk. And she seems to be beset by gypsies and rescued by Frank Churchill. Well, what does it mean to be beset by gypsies? Again, she's a young girl on a country road all by herself. They were bothering her? What does it mean to be bothered by fellows? Austen really gets away with not saying what she doesn't need to say, since she can't use the word rape, given what women could and couldn't say in the 19th century. She can just raise the possibility without saying anything. So it seems like different things happen to the Pamela plot in Emma. On the one hand, the Pamela plot does not happen in the marriage of Harriet and Mr. Elton. They don't get married. But something like it happens in the marriage of Jane Fairfax and Frank. And Frank says about Jane things not unlike what Mr. B says about Pamela. He says, oh, she's really got she's very smart, and she's very good, and she's really going to take care of me. She's going to make me into a better man. There's that plot about the woman moralizing the man. But then, now here's the real problem. Now I can answer the question that you asked me, and that's the question about the marriage of Mr. Knightley and Emma. Because that's the question that bothers feminist readers of Emma, right? The question is, why does Emma have to marry Mr. Knightley, who's almost as bad as Colonel Brandon in Sense and Sensibility, the man who wears a flannel waistcoat? Okay. Austen makes it look like Emma doesn't really have to get married, because she's handsome, clever, and rich. Marriage is not an economic proposition. It seems like marriage is a choice. And that, in fact, is a kind of ideological mystification of the real lives of most women who had to get married if they could. Marriage wasn't a choice. So it seems like Emma chooses to marry Mr. Knightley. And on the one hand, that seems to divert the Pamela plot, to revoke the Pamela plot. It's a choice. It's kind of anti-romantic. Or it's Emma's choice. It's not a matter of necessity. But what happens in that marriage? If you remember the scene in the novel of where they go to Box Hill, and Emma and Frank play nasty games, and they insult Jane Fairfax's aunt, Miss Bates. The argument has been made by millions of literary critics that what's wrong in the Box Hill chapter of Emma is the kind of untrammeled egoism of Emma on the one hand and Frank on the other. And it seems to me that it's not Krista Wolfe, it's Virginia Wolfe, that Austen makes Emma marry Mr. Knightley by way of saying that the only constraint on the kind of untrammeled egoism that Emma represents and Frank represents is whatever it is that Mr. Knightley represents in the novel. And that is, I would argue, again, a morally regenerated patriarchal order. Mr. Knightley is the good patriarch. He's the one with power, but he's not a snob. He's the one who's the proprietor of an estate that's a working farm. And you can see that in all the descriptions of Donwell Abbey in the novel. But still, I mean, Austen can't let her heroines do what she does, which is not get married on the one hand and write on the other hand. And she doesn't want to marry Emma to the sexy man. It's as if that marriage would be too dangerous, which is what one of my students said to me yesterday. So she marries Emma to Mr. Knightley by way of suggesting that that's the only thing that can be done to kind of channel, organize, and constrain all this rather dangerous energy in Emma, energy that I think we can recognize as both artistic and sexual. But it's certainly a patriarchal marriage, because what is it that distinguishes Mr. Knightley? When he proposes to Emma, he says, I've lectured you and blamed you, and you've taken it as no other woman in England would.
Is it a reverse, then, the Pamela story?
No.
That she's been reformed by him?
It seems like a reverse, but what's the same is that he's the one with the power, and that she's transformed into a wife. She says, you know, oh, no, I'm really going to be a good wife. I've changed now. And I mean, the sign in the novel that she's grown up, I mean, to talk about not only genre, but subgenre, the sign in female Bildungsroman of the 19th century that the woman grows up is that she gets married. The sign in male Bildungsroman that the young man grows up is that he gets married and that he gets a job. So, I mean, it's really only half of that asymmetry. So, I mean, as in Mansfield Park, Emma both displaces and therefore resists the Pamela plot and also represents it. And I think it's the same sort of thing.
I see your point, and that is a patriarchal situation, but it's not a complete reversal of the Pamela thing. But I mean, I think there are elements of it which tend to play as a reversal. I mean, Emma's character has some social power. She's vibrant, she's running around, she has lovers, she does horrible things. And Mr. Knightley, I mean, you know, she does. And Mr. Knightley is virtuous and calm and patient, and he morally regenerates her. And when it does come to the marriage, he doesn't assume that she's going to marry him. In fact, he thinks the opposite. He's grateful that she loves him. And I think they come to love each other at a distance, in a friendship sort of way. And I don't think it's absolutely patriarchal.
I don't think it's absolutely, I would agree that it's not absolutely patriarchal. And I think the thing that makes Austen, for me, the greatest English woman, the greatest British woman novelist of the 19th century, is that she suckers me in every time. She makes me believe in every one of those marriages that ends every one of her novels, in face of all the evidence to the contrary. I mean, I think that everything that you're saying is what the novel says. But in fact, if you stand back and look, or, you know, this time I stood back and took a look, it seems like there really is nothing for, there's nothing for Emma to do but get married. And the only man that the novel lets her marry is the only strong man in the novel, in a way that really confirms the strength, power, and authority of men. In this case, moral power, too. I mean, he gets not only his own power, but also Pamela's power, as over against whatever transgressive energy it is that Emma herself represents.
She's conquered her own libido, but he's going to be there to keep an eye on her.
He's going to keep her in line.
Make sure she doesn't stray from
the... He's going to keep her in line. And you can actually see that in the way that Austen describes the marriage of Harriet Smith and Robert Martin, who belongs to the yeomanry. She says it's lucky for Harriet that she could marry somebody like Robert, because he's going to keep her in line. You know, otherwise she'd just go berserk. As, you know, as if she was courting seduction by the gypsies rather than, you know, being in danger of being raped by them.
But, I mean, I really do agree with you, but I do want to play devil's advocate. It's not like Mr. Knightley is running around, but he wants to keep her in line. I mean, you know, the ideal moral status for all the characters is uniform, and he's not necessarily restricting her, you know, her, excluding her from behavior, which he himself engages in.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think that that's really a hallmark of Emma being a novel written by a woman. I mean, I do think that women writers tackle this in a very different way from the way male writers do. And you know, Austen, again, for me, is really interesting because she's precisely so conservative and so radical, both at the same time and in all the same ways.
I wanted to ask Bella a question because my curiosity is piqued now, since you read us that initial scene with mother. What happens during the course of Patterns of Childhood? What sort of relationship is negotiated with the mother? And what does it have to do with writing? I mean, what does it do for her writing?
Well, there are many places in the text where she talks about herself as Nellie dealing with her mother. There are several levels of misunderstanding that have to do with her mother, in a sense. Not telling her what needs to be said. And so, about what they're doing, about what's going on, about what's in the newspapers, about why her father is drafted, about why some people go away and never come back. And but you have the sense until the moment when her mother doesn't get on the truck that she could do nothing else somehow. And then the rest of the book is really about Once Wolf sort of explodes that, and the reader is shocked and oh no, the rest of the book is really about her making it through to the end. And then the ending is really quite, it's also a dream sort of narrative, but it's much more positive. But you have the sense that she did not, well, that the only evidence is really in the text. I mean, in fact, when the manuscript is there, mother, as if the text would speak for itself, that's an aspiration that's never realized. It's unresolved, but all you know is that she wrote it, which is a great testimony, but it doesn't really, I don't think, positively console her. I don't think it comes together there. I think it comes together somewhere else. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if the source of the mystery there wouldn't be that the search for the mother is the search for the mother tongue, that it's really a search for language. And I was also going to ask you how you relate your topic to the other two.
Well, I think that women have, number one, been excluded from the autobiographical canon because they haven't written what have been traditionally called conventional or classic autobiographies.
This sounds to me so au courant, this one.
Which line?
Your topic. It falls into genre, I think, more than gender.
Well, I think women do write autobiographies differently than men, although I will admit I'm not exactly sure where. I mean, there are always exceptions. Simone de Beauvoir's autobiography, I think, is more like a man's.
I mean, she's concerned with memory. Memories speak memory. And that means a concern with language.
Well, I think everyone's concerned with language, though.
Yes, of course, but she particularly in this.
You mean Wolf?
Yes.
Oh, Wolf, for sure.
Wolf.
Yeah. And I think,
so,
yeah.
I was just trying to relate it to the other concerns, which were more gender concern than genre.
Well,
I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, I don't think that she happens to be a feminist writer, and she's very political Eastern.
I mean, in this particular.
Yeah, but in this particular, I don't think gender is particularly an issue for her. I think the issue is, if I could put it in these terms, sort of fatherland and the language that fatherland represents, which is, purity of a certain kind, death, I said, mutation, amputation, destroying of the innocent, et cetera. And then the mother tongue, which is not pure, blameless, but that is somehow implicated, not by choice, seduced by those dreams of patrimony and patriarchy and fatherland. And I think that's where the complication lies. But when you read the whole book, what you're really most affected by is all the levels of language and all the places in which things are hidden and buried and can't be brought out. I mean, she goes through newspaper after newspaper, trying to find out, looking up a particular date to see what it said in, the Berlin or whatever, about a particular transport train. Well, of course, either it says nothing, or it says it in such a coded fashion that only if you knew what you were looking for, would you know what it says.
Exactly what language does.
Well, sure, it does it in every level, and she knows that in a sense she's doing the same thing because she's protecting something about herself too. So that she's so aware of the strategies that autobiography necessarily involves, that I think it hits gender and genre everywhere. It may not be as directed a search. It's really about the self, how do you put yourself on paper, and where are you anyway if you're not there?
Yes.
Where are you?
Where are you? So whether she does it as a woman, is the big question. But I do think that women in autobiography, I am afraid to make an appalling statement, but if you put Gertrude Stein next to Simone de Beauvoir and say they both wrote autobiographies, but look how differently they're written, what are those areas in which some kind of engagement or questioning is taking place that has to do with the self? De Beauvoir, has so fully internalized philosophical language that the I is always way out there, whereas, Stein just fractures it to begin with. But in some sense, they're both certain kinds of explorations, and they're both, I think, defenses against another kind of language that they've had to both internalize and reproduce. But I might be stretching the thesis too far to say that. I'm not sure.
Other questions?
May I go back to the novels for a minute and ask, why do you think that the 19th century English novelists women denied their characters over and over again any of the small freedoms they had, the freedom not to marry, the freedom to write?
The most famous answer to that question is the answer that Gilbert and Hubbard give in The Mad Woman in the Attic. That is that prohibition really is a reflection of what they call women authors' anxiety of authorship. And I think that's a very good explanation.
It's like the movie this morning, how the movie ended, and the suggestion was made that you have to have certain endings to get published or maybe to get printed.
I think that those prohibitions really are always highly mediated through, in lots of different ways. I find Gilbert and Hubbard's answer compelling, although I'm sure it's not the only answer about why women authors didn't let their characters do that.
Doesn't seem enough. Really.
Certainly Austen tends to punish her witty female characters most.
Terribly, and so does George Eliot. She's more cruel to women than Tolstoy could be at his worst.
On the other hand, George Eliot is even crueler to men, because the men all look like nitwits. I mean, the smart women get trashed, but the men all look like nitwits.
Yeah, but at least the men have a chance to go out and ruin themselves.
Yes, that's for sure. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The broad answer, and I don't want to sound unduly glib, is that is the way that even writers who see themselves in some senses as challenging patriarchal norms are governed by those norms. So that, my verb is inflect, so that patriarchal norms inflect female writing.
Who always work line with but you are saying something about available men under patriarchy, or you are saying something something that I think could fall under any strong protest.
Or to take the example, Bella leaned over to me before we started and said, what about Villette? I mean, in Villette, the heroine does not get married, but, Charlotte Bronte has it both ways, because it's shoulda, coulda, woulda. She could have gotten married, only the guy dies at sea. So that's an ending that providentially saves her from a situation where she would really be buried by his extraordinary power and authority, where Lucy would be, buried under the power and authority of Monsieur Paul. Yes.
I think read somewhere, I heard that Charlotte originally wanted to have him die, his name is the one line, but that her father wanted an elephant in me, and that's why she changed the meaning. Yes, I don't know if that's true.
I don't know. You had a question.
No, I just had an idea that maybe the reason that they shamed most of the novels that way is because that's the way it really happened in reality. Generally, there were a lot more women who did get married when they were supposed to than protest, openly or whatever.
Yeah, although I think that's both true and not true, because many of these novels are really instances of special pleading and special cases. In particular, Emma, which is about a woman who doesn't have to get married, or Pride and Prejudice, which makes it look like Elizabeth gets married because she wants to and not because she has to. So I mean, again, there's a constant push and pull between what was ordained by, to use Austen's metaphor again, by the norms of patriarchal and bourgeois ideology, and how it is that women undertook to challenge that. And really, I mean, rather than to challenge explicitly, to subvert it in one way or another. And what I've become interested in is how that subversion operates on the level of plot. I mean, to take another example, in Shirley by Charlotte Bronte, there's one Pamela marriage and one un-Pamela marriage. There's one marriage between a kind of vulnerable and simpy heroine. And then there's the marriage of Shirley and a man who doesn't seem to be the kind of big, powerful figure. But we should all remember that in the 19th century, Shirley was a man's name.
It seems like marriage is the end goal that all of Austen's books just funnel right. To prepare the woman or whatever.
That's female necessity.
Doesn't work.
Marriage or the convent.
Yeah, I actually think that
the male or the
But I think that they really are anti-epithalamia. I mean, you know, it's been pointed out that in the, if you look at the way that Austen's novels end, in every one of the endings, she goes like this. Okay, you know, I've solved this problem. Yeah, you know, goodbye. She doesn't, especially Dickens ends his novels by reveling in telling you what happens to all the characters later in life. And Austen just dispatches the marriages in a big hurry.
She's disgusting.
Because that's what she's doing her business.
Especially in Dickens, and only in a single paragraph, Marianne is totally coerced by the other three members of this parallelogram to make a fourth. You know, it happens in three sentences. And she's clearly playing with something, or else she's deadly serious there. I don't think it's that she doesn't know what she's doing.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, don't you find it problematic the way rape is treated in a lot of 19th century novels?
Or the way it's not treated.
Or not treated. I mean, I remember last semester reading Kleist, the Marquis of Vaux, where she's raped when she's unconscious, and then at the end she marries the man who raped her, and finds out, she knows all along really that he was the one that raped her, and then it's really supposed to be a sort of happy ending, that they are married and everyone accepts it, that's okay, since he's marrying her, so it's okay that he raped her. Yeah.
That I think is a really interesting area for comparison and contrast of novels written by women and novels written by men. I mean, Tess of the D'Urbervilles is also a novel about rape.
Clarissa.
And Clarissa is the classic novel about rape. But I think that first of all, men got to talk about rape much more explicitly than women did, at least in England, because they weren't governed by quite the same codes of propriety that governed women. But I think in some sense Richardson really believed in the Pamela plot. I don't mean, you know, that you have to take belief with a kind of grain of salt here. I think that plot, which rendered seduction harmless, was a plot that only a man could believe in. I mean, that's really what I'm trying to get at here. That women don't believe that seduction, which is code for rape, is harmless in the same way that men do. And it's why Pamela and Tess of the D'Urbervilles and the Marquise of O are more alike than they are like Mansfield Park, Bleak House, Ruth by Elizabeth Gaskell, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
May I just suggest that in Georges Sand, whose work is gigantic, there are very many solutions and issues to a woman's particular position, situation. She's in another 19th century, I mean, novelist, and that was a topic of a panel once, Power and Powerlessness, and both, and Swedish Woman. There's Victorious Woman Victorious. There's Raped Woman.
And so what is her, you know, what are the solutions?
Oh, well, when you have the Raped Woman, you have Victorious Woman, you have solutions. Well, it's fiction, of course. You have woman who doesn't compromise. You have woman who somehow is victorious through almost death, because she is so much humiliated and betrayed that all she opposes is a kind of a sinking into death. There's so much variety that
that's the Clarissa plot.
Mm-hmm. No, I think a good theme is the whole suicide theme in 19th century fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, the veil, and the shroud.
Born bridal shroud in a day. That's it.
Is there, this may sound very naive question, but is there, I love the way your paper ended with, you know, that's another story. Is there, can you look at 19th century and early 20th century literature and find a correlation between where the next generation of authors pick up the story? In other words, the story might start after the marriage, and certainly does in contemporary literature, doesn't it? It's not, I mean, is there kind of a pattern that...
After the divorce.
Right, all right.
Well, certainly, life without marriage is more possible in novels written after 1850 than before. And in fact, you know, what the argument runs that women writers structure their plots differently, that marriage isn't ever, or, you know, isn't always the end. But curiously, marriage is not the end in Pamela either, it's in the middle. I mean, that's something that most readers forget. I mean, it seems like the most important episode in that novel is the marriage of Pamela and Mr. B. But it's not, but it, I mean, it's only part of the story, because the last third of the novel is about the society around Mr. B, his, you know, all the members of the gentry, approving this marriage, which otherwise looked outrageous to them. And, you know, Pamela conquers all of them, and also Mr. B's sister, who disapproves of the marriage because, what does Mr. B's sister disapprove of the marriage? Because she doesn't want her husband marrying beneath him, her brother marrying beneath him. Or her husband married beneath him, that too. And she doesn't like the way that that marriage reconfirms male power. I mean, she's trashed in the novel as being a kind of premature feminist, very quietly.
I just wanted to say that in Mariah, which was written by Marion Wollstonecraft, who's pre-1850, that marriage is introduced sort of even pre-beginning, in a sense, and never really the issue. Only toward the end when she's involved with, sort of quasi-involved with, I forget his name. Like, marriage is never the issue. She focuses basically on the wrongs that occurred in the marriage and how he mistreated her. So there are novels that don't focus on marriage necessarily.
Yeah.
I think Austin saw marriage.
The seduction.
I think Austin saw marriage as an economic necessity more than anything else. Which is why, I mean, I don't know, I didn't know the one, but why women married so often was because they couldn't support themselves. I mean, there was very little means of support unless you were either born into money for whatever reason, or you had some talent and you were able to survive on your own, but it was never an encouraged thing for women to subsist on their own. So they saw it as a way of gaining economic, of surviving, of eating, of feeding children, of helping relatives who needed money.
Comments? Just we don't have
a question.
Question
to you about Epithalamium. Now, if it does mean, as I haven't, just the celebration of marriage, would you again say, I mean, your poets do this, celebrate marriage? It's a naive question, and I appreciated that, everything you said, but
women poets don't celebrate marriage a lot, for the same reasons the women characters sort of resist the marriage plot in novels, I think. And I think for good reason. I mean, for the most part, they associate marriage with the loss of something rather than the gaining of something. And that's why, for male poets, first of all, the marriage poems are astonishingly unpersonal. I mean, the sort of history of the ethical landing is astonishingly unpersonal. They're public poems, public pronouncements. And usually, the poet is straining after someone's recognition of him, poetically speaking. Or male poets tend to disembody love. In other words, Plato, Freud, Dante have always told us that the real purpose of what we really want to do is transcend sort of human and bodily love and move in the direction of the immortal forms or some kind of meaningful work or whatever they had in mind. And I generally feel that when women poets do write about marriage, and they often don't write in epithalamic form specifically, because those kinds of rigidly codified forms were not open to them, were not really encouraged. And also, as I said, it's trying to pick up a right-handed object with your left hand, because it's not ordinarily written from the bride's perspective anyway. So she's displaced to begin with when she tries to use that genre. But when women poets do write about marriage, they almost, without exception, write anti-epithalamic. Or else they write about often mothers, oddly enough. This is the, and I tried to sort of suggest some of the reasons why, but I think that, you know, Chodorow's suggestion about the bisexual position of women, the fact that there is some sense of passing from a female bond to a male bond, from transferring love object from mother to father. But they do experience it as a loss, and I think that it's been firmly narrative as well. A loss of power, a loss of autonomy, control over one's own life, and often as a violation.
I think you can see that in a different way in your paper about Wolf, because she talks about herself as Nellie and as you, but never as I. I mean, I think that that's really part of the same thing, but in a obviously a very postmodern kind of way.
The splitting.
Yeah.
I mean, sort of a depressing thought. You know, it sort of leaves us kind of in a sad place, which is why I tried to end this paper with some new songs in which women poets actually do act as subjects and do negotiate their own contracts and do have a notion of love that's vibrant and alive and shared and stuff like that. But I think really the history of women's fiction and the history of women's poetry on the issue of marriage has been a fairly depressing one. Any other comments or thoughts? Thank you very much for coming.